Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Maybe you've had this experience where you think, everybody says how great this person's music is, and I don't really know it. Well, at some point I realized that I just didn't really know Joni Mitchell's music very well, except for the occasional hit like, you know, Paved Paradise and Put Up a Parking Lot. I mean, she's great and all, it just wasn't music I grew up listening to. So I decided I needed to have at least one Joni Mitchell record in my collection, and more or less at random, I got her record called Mingus. It was made in 1979, shortly before the great jazz bassist Charles Mingus died. It's a really interesting album, and in between songs, you hear stuff like this.
Now, Duke will be 77 years old, right?
Right.
I gotta cut him.
Thought that must be strong, you know.
I gotta cut Duke.
I know, it's hard to make out what he's saying, but that was Charlie Mingus, talking about how Duke Ellington lived to be 77 and how he was going to cut the Duke, you know, top him. Well, he wouldn't get the chance, as Mingus died later in 1979 at the age of 56. Mingus had a strange way of talking, and you wouldn't want to listen to hours of tape of him being interviewed. Now, you don't have to. Music writer John F. Goodman did hours of interview with Mingus and has now transcribed them for a new book. We'll hear about that, and we'll remember another jazz figure who passed away too early, pianist Mulgrew Miller, a fixture on the New York scene for over 30 years, who passed away this week at the age of 57. Also, an excerpt from our live centennial celebration of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, featuring pianist Vicky Chow. So it's a busy edition of Soundcheck. Let's get started. Mingus Speaks is the title of John F. Goodman's new book about this colorful, charismatic, irascible, and troubled bass player and composer. The book is built around his interviews with Mingus and Mingus's associates, recorded back in the 70s. John joins me here in the Soundcheck studio. Welcome.
Hi. Glad to be with you.
So these conversations that you had with Charles Mingus, where was he in the arc of his career at that point?
Mingus was just coming out of a really bad period for himself. He was probably for 6 to 7 years, he was pretty much withdrawn from everything, the whole music scene. He had some health problems and was just in a kind of a bad way. But he began to play again and finally came back around 1972.
Mm-hmm. So the concert at Lincoln Center at what we now call Avery Fisher Hall, back mm-hmm. then it was Philharmonic Hall, that eventually becomes a live record, mm-hmm. which when you reviewed it, you said it was almost more like a rehearsal than a concert. Was that because of it? Was it informal with people coming and going?
It was kind of a typical Mingus concert. he had a disastrous concert at Town Hall in the 60s, in the early 60s. And it was the music just fell apart. It was so complicated and difficult that they hadn't had the rehearsal time to be able to play it well. And Mingus would stop the band. He did a little of that at the Philharmonic Hall concert. And I think he was such a perfectionist about so many things in his music that it was frequently interrupted by Mingus's coaching or whatever.
Well, he was also known as a kind of provocateur, and he loved to provoke not just his audiences, but his musicians as well.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Was there some of that going on that evening?
Well, I don't think that, not so much, but he was very concerned, since this was his first public appearance in a long time, he was very concerned to get the music right.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if somebody played an off note or something went not quite rhythmically right, he would say, okay, we're going to repeat that, bar number, bup, bup.
Well, the results of that concert are on this record called Charles Mingus and Friends in Concert. This piece has one of his typical punning titles. He loved his puns. E's flat, Oz flat 2. Flat, Oz Flat 2, Charles Mingus and Friends in Concert, 1972 comeback concert and album. John F. Goodman, my guest, is the author of the new book Mingus Speaks, based on his own conversations with Mingus around this time. He reviewed that concert, in fact, for Playboy magazine back in 1972. When he finally comes back at this big concert at Lincoln Center, what is the reaction of the industry at large? Is it like, oh, Charles Mingus is back, let's start putting out albums, or you know?
It wasn't quite that strong.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Yeah, there was some of that. There really was. And he worked with Tio Massaro, who was a famous producer of jazz and such. And they did put out some records and some really good ones, Let My Children Hear Music.
So the album Let My Children Hear Music, this is one of the things that we get out of your various conversations with Mingus is, despite the fact that he is this great figure in jazz, he loved classical music. And
yes.
He talks about it constantly in the book. And some of that seems to be in evidence in this record, in Let My Children Hear Music.
Oh, definitely. You particularly in the Adagio piece.
Adagio ma non troppo.
Yes. It was completely original to Mingus. I don't hear any kind of copying or appropriating of, but it has a very obvious classical feel to it and some classical form, in fact.
Just a little bit of Charles Mingus's piece, Adagio ma non troppo, a marking that you would find quite frequently in classical music. It means slow, but not too slow. Let My Children Hear Music, 1972 album by Charles Mingus. So this is about the time, John Goodman, where you began this series of interviews with him. It's his comeback, as you mentioned before. John, what was Mingus like as a storyteller, as an interview subject?
There's never been a better interview subject, in my opinion. I mean, he was very difficult with people. I was lucky, and for some reason we got on well from the beginning. I went backstage after the concert and met him, and I was a little bit nervous. His reputation in many ways preceded him, and he was very warm, mm-hmm. very open, great, enormous, big man, and I think part of the fact that I wrote for Playboy was sort of a kick for him. He loved to talk about sex and women and all of it. But he was always with me, very approachable, sometimes moody. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there was a lot of dead air, you know, and you would just sort of sit there and wait until the appropriate time to pick it up again.
So you recorded all of these conversations.
I recorded all this, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he had a very strange, almost elliptical way of speaking. I mean, just his speaking voice was unusual, wasn't it?
Very difficult to understand, John. It took me a long time to you know, get it.
Yeah.
Like I call it machine gun style. He'd speak very fast and in a slurred kind of way, so that you really had to learn kind of a new dialect to pick it up.
And it's pretty amazing the very few times in your book where you actually have to resort to, you know, unintelligible or words to that effect when transcribing these interviews. Here is the man himself. This is Charles Mingus speaking with John F. Goodman during a larger conversation about avant-garde music. And once again, his sort of love of classical music comes out in this clip, if you can make out what he's saying.
You think about it, man, even the guys in the jungles, man, they weren't just born as a baby and picked up a drum. Their daddy taught them how to play drums to send the messages and all that. You know,
right.
You just say, well, man, I'm Jesus born here. Hand me a drum,
just
baby.
Lay
me a flute on me. Run me a clarinet next. Now I'm going to play a little bass. Where's Yasha Heifetz's violin? I'll play that for you better than him. Now when you get through, hand me Isaac Stearns. I'll play that better than him.
That is Charles Mingus. So not content with cutting his fellow jazz musicians, he's calling out Yasha Heifetz and Isaac Stern.
Mingus was one of these traditionalists about music and musical training, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things that comes across constantly in the interviews that we did. He looked down on people who did not study and did not work at their music and did not understand the jazz traditions. Mm-hmm. And that was really important to him. And that's kind of what the clip is about.
Yeah. And the cutting contests, the old jazz tradition of musicians sort of doing battle with each other to show how much they had mastered their instrument and their music, that was important to him, too.
Very much so. Yeah.
So what was his kind of overall take on the avant-garde? He seems to have been kind of suspicious of how much actual musicality was behind that.
Well, he was suspicious, and more than that, he was very critical about some of what he heard. And he, at the beginning of our interviews, we had a lot of talk about the avant-garde, and mm-hmm. it's a big chapter in my book. And he didn't want to name names, but we did name some names.
Yeah.
I think, John, he felt that a lot of these people were taking advantage of the big interest that was arising in so-called free jazz, and they were not really prepared like somebody like Eric Dolphy, for instance, who played with Mingus for quite a few years. And who knew
and who
how
played,
to play that
flute
music
and saxophone, yeah.
And had training, and
yeah.
And had a tremendous facility with his reed instruments.
He seems not to have known what to make of Ornette Coleman. That, you know, early on in the book he says some pretty critical things, but then later in the book he says, well, you know, but people respond to us. He must have something that I'm not hearing, which for Mingus, it seems, was a pretty different thing for him to say, you know, not what you would have expected from him.
That's absolutely right. I'm glad you picked up on that, because one reviewer thought I was just putting, and Mingus was just putting down Ornette Coleman throughout, and that's not right. there was something that Mingus did here in Ornette's music. And in fact, in an early album, I think 1960, pre-Bird maybe it was, Mingus did. You could hear the influence of some of Ornette's music in the way Mingus's group played.
We're speaking with John F. Goodman. He's the author of the new book, Mingus Speaks, about the great jazz bassist and composer and pianist, Charles Mingus. How reliable is Charles Mingus as a narrator of the actual history of the music and of his own life?
He wrote a fictionalized, shall we say, autobiography called Beneath the Underdog, which was it was fairly popular. 1971. Again, it came out around the same time. And it's a book that has a lot of, I want to be accurate and say, distortion in it. A lot of myth-making and a lot of wonderful stuff that really did reflect Mingus's life. So he had this tendency to mix what we would call, I guess, reality and his own ideas of how a piece like that or a fiction like that should come together.
Mm-hmm. So we've had a lot of memoirists sort of called on the carpet in recent years for mixing fact and myth-making or fiction or whatever term you want to use for it. Sounds like Mingus was ahead of the curve with that. Mm-hmm. He was also known for these legendary outbursts of anger at other musicians, at his own musicians. Were you on the receiving end of any of that?
No, never. Fortunately, but sure, he had a terrible temper. Mm-hmm. I mean, and there are all kinds of stories, and some of them are repeated in the book.
Right.
And it's just undeniable that the man had a fierce temper, which I think as time went along, at least in the two or three years that I was talking with him, it kind of moderated. Mm-hmm. I did not hear the kinds of stories that about punching people and holding knives on people and the kind of stuff that he did back in the 1950s.
Now, by the time you were interviewing him, this series of interviews that extended through, what, 1974?
Correct.
Did you see any evidence of Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, which would eventually kill him?
Nobody knew what he had. It took a long time for them to diagnose what was ailing him. He was tremendously concerned about his health in most all the time that I knew him. He had problems with his knees. He had problems with what the doctors called congestive heart failure at one point. He's worried about his weight and a whole number of things. Mm-hmm. I think he, toward the end, he looked like a different person to me. And the last time I saw him was in a club in New York. I think it was around 1977. And they were playing in the Vanguard or someplace, and the music wasn't very good. And he and I had a kind of strange, perfunctory reunion. He didn't look right. He looked bad. And I've got to believe that Mingus knew he was in a very bad way, but I'm sure they didn't know anything about Lou Gehrig's disease until he and Sue went to Mexico to try some cures.
Right. That's Sue Mingus, his wife. The book is called Mingus Speaks, a collection of conversations with Mingus and with some of his fellow musicians and producers by my guest, John F. Goodman. The book is out now, and John, he is, in death as in life, a larger-than-life character, and great reading. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, the jazz pianist Mulgrew Miller passed away this week. We'll hear his last visit to the WNYC studio when he joined us with Ron Carter's Golden Striker Trio back in 2011. Eleanor Friedberger launched her career as half of the sibling duo The Fiery Furnaces, then released a well-received solo debut 2 years ago. On Monday, she joins us to play songs from her new album called Personal Record, live at 2 p.m. on soundcheck.org.
I don't want to bother you, but there's something to say that I want you to hear. It's hard when you're far, I forget when you're near. I'd rather be 2 inches from your face than floating about in a different state.
That's Eleanor Friedberger. Listen to her record a session for an upcoming Soundcheck broadcast live at 2 p.m. Eastern on Monday at soundcheck.org. We learned this week of the passing of jazz pianist Mulgrew Miller. He died on Wednesday of a stroke in Allentown, Pennsylvania. He was just 57 years old. In the background, you're hearing Miller play with his group Wingspan, one of the ensembles he led as a solo artist. Mulgrew Miller left a big mark on the careers of others. On the one hand, he mentored young musicians as the director of jazz studies at William Patterson University in New Jersey. On the other hand, Mulgrew Miller was a very well-traveled sideman. He worked with Betty Carter, the drummer Art Blakey, trumpeter Woody Shaw, drummer Tony Williams, and bassist Ron Carter. Mulgrew played in Carter's Golden Striker Trio, a group that joined us in the Soundcheck studio back in 2011. We're going to listen back to some of that performance tonight. The first piece is called, appropriately, Golden Striker. It's the Golden Striker Trio, Ron Carter on bass, Russell Malone on guitar, and the late pianist Mulgrew Miller.
Thank you.
That's Ron Carter and the Golden Striker Trio playing the piece that gave the group its name, Golden Striker, written by John Lewis of the Modern Jazz Quartet. The trio was led by bassist Ron Carter with guitarist Russell Malone and featured the pianist Mulgrew Miller, who passed away this week at the age of 57. We're remembering him by listening back to his final visit to our WNYC studio, which took place in 2011. Here's a song that didn't make it on the air that night because, well, we ran out of time, but we can hear it now. It's the Fletcher Henderson number, Soft Winds. Once again, this is Ron Carter's Golden Striker Trio, featuring pianist Mulgrew Miller. Thank you. That's Soft Winds, composed by Fletcher Henderson and performed in the Soundcheck studio back in 2011 by the Golden Striker Trio. Ron Carter on bass, Russell Malone on guitar, and the pianist Mulgrew Miller. He passed away this week. He was 57. Up next, a rare arrangement of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring in honor of its 100th birthday this week. We'll hear an excerpt from Vicky Chow's live performance in the Green Space. Next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. 100 years ago this week, things got a little out of hand at the premiere of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring in Paris. It was May 29th, 1913. So when Soundcheck and Q2 Music teamed up this past Wednesday to present an unusual arrangement of this still provocative work, I was prepared for all eventualities, armed with a riot helmet and a bullhorn. And you can see a photo on our Facebook page if you think I'm joking. I put the audience on notice there would be no fisticuffs, no shouting, no, to quote a member of the orchestra that infamous night, no gentlemen wielding canes like menacing implements of combat. Well, things did not get out of hand. Vicky Chow, the pianist of the Bang on a Can All-Stars, did play a wonderful and rare solo piano arrangement of the Rite of Spring, and we'll hear a bit of that in a moment. And you can watch the whole thing on soundcheck.org. But I started out by talking with composer Phil Klein, who, on Wednesday, was in the middle of hosting a 24-hour Rite of Spring marathon on Q2 Music, and I asked him about that infamous premiere.
We know way too much about this. This is the most over-publicized riot in history. It's a little bit like Woodstock. Everybody was there.
Right, right, right.
I think the quality of the drugs overall was better in Paris, but a similar situation.
So a little absinthe making the heart grow fonder over the years.
Everything I used to know about this event has turned out to be untrue. Like, I really wish that Camille Saint-Saëns had been in the audience and at the beginning when he heard the bassoon solo said, "What is that instrument?" But he wasn't even there.
Oh, that's one of my favorite stories.
I know, it's one of the best. But it's almost true. See, a lot of these things are half true. He went to one of the first concert performances and walked out. As did, Puccini went to the first concert performance and walked out, continuously saying, "He's mad! He's mad!" I love that.
On the other hand, it's not like complete, you know, made up hoo ha. I mean, there was quite a to do.
There was a
100 years ago tonight.
I think it resembled maybe something more like the climactic scene in A Night at the Opera. You know, where Chico and Harpo were throwing the baseball back and forth, and Margaret Dumont's going clutching her pearls. It was a little bit more like that.
Well, I want to play for you. This is from a 1968 interview with Dame Marie Rambert. She was one of the dancers in the company that actually did the ballet that historic night when the Rite of Spring was debuted in Paris. Listen to this.
It was an absolute pandemonium. There was a lady who, a very elegant lady, who leaned out of her box like that, hit a man in the face, you know, slapped. But I can't remember whether she was hissing or whether she was clapping. But all I can say is that he obviously was doing the opposite.
So a piece that divided opinions very, very quickly.
There was definitely a lot of noise in the hall. Everybody agrees with that.
Is this one of those pieces that over the course of a century has sort of maintained a certain malleability that lots of people have found new things to bring to it or new ways to say the old things?
Absolutely. I think the reputation of the piece, when I talk to musicians, especially as we've been interviewing composers and presenters, it seems like the esteem in which the work is held has only risen. It's stronger than ever. And if there's anything that happens, I know for me with this 100th birthday thing, I realize that, like, I'm no longer going to think about the riot. It's not the scandal piece anymore. It's just like one of the greatest pieces I've ever heard. It's this unbelievably complex, regenerative thing that even for a young composer, if I wanted to tell a young composer, here's all the things in the world you can do in a half an hour with an orchestra. Look at this, because it's all there. And if you tried to do every one of those things, you'd never make it sound like that. But it doesn't matter, because there's just like every lesson in the world as far as rhythm, grooves, building on grooves, color, you know, mutation, it's an amazing lesson, and every time I listen to it, I still like it.
And speaking of building, Leonard Bernstein had an interesting kind of clip where he demonstrated how some of those very dissonant harmonies are actually built out of very, very simple means. Take a listen to this. This is Leonard Bernstein prior to conducting the Rite of Spring with the London Philharmonic and talking about actually the chords that we heard when I made my rather dramatic entrance here this evening.
You remember that famous series of chords that comes near the beginning? Remember that stamping dance of the adolescents? What this chord really is two perfectly normal, everyday triadic chords put together. One is this. No objection to that, right? And the other is... No objection to that, right? Stamped out this way, it makes a marvelous kind of savage sound, but it's not just arbitrary dissonance. You follow my point. And very often, he will take a very simple little Russian folk theme and just do it in parallel minor nines. You see, making...
So that's actually from a DVD called Leonard Bernstein, Stravinsky and Sibelius. And the two clips we just heard, by the way, came to us from WNYC's Sarah Fischko, who did a couple of pieces for us around this centennial of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, and who couldn't be here with us tonight. I suspect she just didn't have the proper riot gear and was afraid of what might happen. All right, so what is going to happen tonight? How unusual, Phil, is it to hear the Rite of Spring in a solo piano version?
Well, of course, that's the way it was written in the first place, although I imagine Stravinsky was playing part of it and imagining the rest and then writing it all down. But he wrote it, well, he wrote at least the first half of the piece in a little room in, I believe the name of the town is Clarens, Switzerland. Little room, little upright piano. So there's that. There are two authorized versions that he made. One is the two-piano version, which... kind of wonderfully, I loved when I heard this. In some of the rehearsals, those parts were played by Stravinsky and Debussy together. I wish we had a bootleg of that somewhere.
Yeah.
But and then Stravinsky was in love with the player piano right around the time he wrote The Rite of Spring, and he worked very hard with this company called the Aeolian Company that produced pianolas, and he oversaw the production of a piano roll, which exists. And I've also heard three piano, four piano versions. So doing it for solo piano is like one of the ultimate high wire acts. Not only what do you have to play, but think of all the things you can't play. What are you going to leave out? How are you going to keep the thread going? What are you going to pick to keep it going? It requires, you've got to really be able to get out there and sell it. So, you know, that Vicky is a very brave woman, and she'll show you.
And fortunately for us, a very talented one. She's been playing... round and about as part of the Bang on a Can All-Stars, a leading new music group here in New York for a number of years. And Phil Klein, sort of a culmination of this 24-hour marathon that you've curated. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you all for joining us. Now please welcome to the stage, at last, the pianist Vicky Chow to play Stravinsky's Rite of Spring.
Thank you.
That's an excerpt from Vicky Chow's solo piano performance of The Rite of Spring, recorded this past Wednesday downstairs in the green space on the 100th anniversary of the premiere of this infamous Stravinsky work. Vicky's performance was great, and you can watch the whole thing. Find the video on our site, soundcheck.org. Monday on the show, music writer Lizzie Goodman joins us with new releases from Eleanor Friedberger, Vampire Weekend, and Quadrin. And we'll talk with some of the contributors behind a new essay collection called Yes is the Answer and Other Prog Rock Tales. Before we talk with them, we're asking you, what is prog rock? How do you define it? Call us at 866-939-1612 or tweet us at Soundcheck with the hashtag ProgRock. We might use your answer on the show. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, George Wellington, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. Special thanks to Q2 and The Green Space for their help with The Rite of Spring Goes Solo. The show is produced by Katie Bishop, Greta Cohn, and Mike Katziff, with Alex Kappelman and our intern, Ian Petrarca. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. Our staff saying goodbye this week to intern Caroline Scannell. Caroline, best of luck, and thanks for all your help this spring. That's all for tonight. See you back here Monday at 9. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.